You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And on today's show, our studio guest is crime writer Kate Rhodes. She's talking about her latest novel, Ruin Beach. We'll carry on the crime theme when we hear from YA writer Julia Golding, talking about her novel, The Curious Crime. And we'll also hear from Acosta Short Story Award winner Caroline Ward-Vine. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Kate. Nice to have you here.
Thanks, Lee. It's lovely to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we're talking to Caroline later, who won the Acosta Short Story Award. You're a short story writer too and a poet. You were. Are you still?
It's actually quite hard to find the time. I hate to say that, but yeah, I wrote a couple of books of poetry and really, really enjoyed it. But most of my short stories have actually been crime related. So I really am impressed that your next speaker has won the Acosta Prize, because I know that they get tens of thousands of applicants. It's really, really tough competition. So she's done incredibly well.
So novels, short stories, poetry, they're different skills, aren't they? Different use of language,
well,
different
pacing.
Well,
you know what? I always say to people that I think writing is writing. So if you can write a short story, you can write a novel. It's partly about belief. But I think that if you're going to write a short story, it's a particularly demanding art form, because you've got such a short space of time to develop your characters, to develop your plot, to make everything come good. So I think it's a really challenging art form. I think it's probably one that I'm going to steer clear of in future. Stick to the novels.
Well, we'll be talking to you about your novel, Ruin Beach, in just a moment. But we'll hear your first choice of music now, which is Nina Simone and My Baby Just Cares For Me. Why this one?
This is a really special song for me because I saw Nina Simone live at Ronnie Scott's in London when I was 18 years old. I was newly in love. I had a fantastic, happy life. It was all going well. And she sang beautifully. I love this song.
Nina Simone and My Baby Just Cares For Me, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest Kate Rhodes. Kate began her writing career as a poet, winning a Bridport Prize and twice being shortlisted for the Forward Prize. In 2014, she won the Ruth Rendell Short Story Prize. She's written 5 crime novels in the acclaimed Alice Quentin series, and her new Hell Bay series is set on the Isles of Scilly. The second in the series, Ruin Beach, is out in paperback this month, and the third, Burnt Island, comes out in June. The Daily Express described her as one of Britain's most elegant and underrated crime novelists. I would agree with that, Kate, indeed. But it's a very crowded market, the crime market, isn't it? There's a lot of crime novels out there.
I've got to admit, I love that quote. I mean, the idea of being elegant and underrated, I suppose it's being better than being scruffy and overrated, isn't it, really? But you're quite right, it is a really overcrowded market. So I think publishers really do struggle to get good books onto the shelves of bookshops these days, because there are a limited number of spaces, there are an absolute truckload of fantastic writers out there. So I think it's, in some ways, it's never been tougher to make a buck as a writer. I love my job. I'm not complaining about it. But I think some people think that you're earning a mint, but actually it's not an amazingly well-paid profession, unless you're J.K. Rowling, of course.
And crime is the best seller, though, isn't it? I think it's something like 7 out of every 10 novels sold are crime novels. What is it about crime, do you think, that readers enjoy? Why does it intrigue us so?
I think it's partly the opportunity to enter into a world which is infinitely more dangerous than our own. It's a bit like when we go to a fairground and we go down the Helter Skelter or we go on the Wall of Death. You know, we do things that we wouldn't do in our everyday lives. And yet when we get to the end of the ride or the end of the book, we're perfectly safe. We're wrapped up in bed drinking cocoa. So I think it exposes us to dangers that we would never normally experience, which is quite an adrenaline rush if the writing's good, I think.
Was it always going to be crime for you that you wrote?
I think I've got a fairly dark imagination. I think crime writing, particularly crime writing which sits on the cusp with literary fiction, allows you to go any way you like in your writing. You know, it can be as dark or as light as you want. I think that actually these days crime writing is a very broad church. You can sort of really... Yeah, broad church, absolutely. You can kind of run amok with your style and enjoy your writing as a crime writer these days, because it used to just be, you know, Agatha Christie and a few other crime writers, and now it's a massive range of different types of crime. So I think, yeah, it's quite a liberating style to write inside.
And we're going to be talking about Ruined Beach. For those who haven't read Ruined Beach, what's it about?
Well, it's set on the island of Tresco, which is one of the Scilly Islands, down off the coast of Cornwall, about 40 kilometres into the Atlantic. So these tiny little islands, I mean, the Tresco, where Ruined Beach is set, is only 2 miles long, are very exposed to the elements. You know, Tresco even has its own microclimate because it's got the world-famous Abbey Gardens on it. And I used to go there a lot. I got taken there a lot as a child in the summer holidays. My parents really loved that kind of escape from reality that you get from going to tiny islands. And Ruined Beach is all about the diving community that flock to Tresco every summer because there are an enormous number of shipwrecks around the coast of Tresco. It's a really, really dangerous, you know, part of the world for marine navigation, because before the oceans rose, these were mountains, these were mountaintops. So you can imagine just how craggy and exposed the rock is beneath the surface of the ocean. So there are literally thousands of shipwrecks to be explored if you're a diver. So it's about the diving community. And it was a blast to write. I had to do lots of research about diving.
Oh, I learned a lot about the Scilly Islands as well.
Oh, good.
I mean, I guess as a writer, it offers you something as well, being in an island community. You've got an isolated group of people, so
yes.
A finite group of suspects.
Yeah.
The fact of crime happening
Absolutely.
In a beautiful place.
Yes. I mean, the total population of Tresco is less than 200 people. So it gives you this tiny, very close-knit community to work inside where everybody suspects everybody else. So it becomes a real hotbed of sort of panic and fear, which is quite fertile terrain for a crime writer to work on.
And how close to the geography do you say? Because there must have been times you thought, oh, I wish I could move that a bit closer.
Well, somebody on Tresco said to me that they thought I'd made it a bit more hilly and mountainous than it actually is, to give it a bit of kind of dramatic oomph. I think I've tried to stay as close to the actual geography as I can. I've exploited a couple of opportunities. There's a sea cave there called Piper's Hole, which is where quite a bit of the action takes place in Ruined Beach. And I made it a bit deeper and a bit darker than it actually is, with a little bit of dramatic license. But so far, the locals have been very forgiving. They've put up with my, my poetic flights of fancy.
But what I thought you did really well was sort of differentiate between local life and tourist life, that there was these things going on that were deeply impacting on the local community tourists didn't know about.
Yes, and I think that's absolutely true from having spent quite large chunks of time there. I think, you know, tourists, we've all done it. You float in and out of a place without ever really knowing about the politics of the place, what really makes it work as a community. And I loved the idea that there were these two sets of people sort of living in tandem but never really interacting that much. That helped me a lot in the story.
And this is the second novel to feature Ben.
Yes.
Ben Kitto. We know you for your Alice Quentin series. So where did Ben come from? I mean, where do you start when you're inventing a new detective, a new protagonist?
Yeah, it was very unexpected. I mean, I decided that I wanted to write some books set in the Isles of Scilly and just started to kind of dream up some stories. And this Cornishman arrived in the story, this huge sort of giant of a man. He's 6'5". He's an enormous person. And I'm only 5'4". I'm not particularly big. So he's absolutely, and he's a lot younger than me, he's a tremendous leap away from who I am. But I think there was something really satisfying about writing about somebody very, very different to me. It's a bit like ventriloquism. You know, you're throwing your voice into another character. And if you can pull that off and convince people, That's really satisfying. That's a challenge met as a writer. But I've got very fond of Ben and his dog, Shadow.
Oh, Shadow.
I really, really enjoy writing about both of them. They're sort of inseparably linked in my mind now.
How do you put him together? I know, I think it was Ian McCune said he sits down and he interviews each of his characters and asks them questions in a kind of Mike Lee fashion to create a character.
I always think about characters, I mean, I sort of think, well, what can he do and what can't he do? You know, this is a guy who hates football but loves to swim. He's somebody who can play the piano but never goes to listen to music. So he's a kind of contrary person. And I think the way I put him together was through his contradictions. I wanted him to be layered, to have lots to him, because I knew I was probably going to write 4 or 5 books about him. So he had to interest me. He had to have enough complexity and enough hinterland to keep me going over 5 or 6 books. And so far, I'm on book 4 he has. So
Did you know where his story was going when you wrote book one?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, if you're starting to plan a series, you need to have an arc for your main character, you know, whether you're going to kill them off at the end, whether you're going to keep them alive, whether you're going to allow them to fall in love and stay there. You need to have a kind of aspiration in mind for your character, I think.
You just casually say, kill them off. I suppose you've killed quite a lot of people in your novels,
Kate.
Yes,
I'm afraid I have. I think it would be a shame to kill him off, but you never know.
You never know. Oh, well, thank you, Kate. We'll come back to you in just a moment, but let's hear from Caroline Ward-Vine now. Caroline finished her MA in creative writing at Anglia Ruskin University last year. Her short stories have been shortlisted for the Bridport Prize and the Bath Short Story Award. I met Caroline at Anglia Ruskin University last month before she knew that she'd won the Costa Short Story Award. I asked her how it felt to be shortlisted.
It feels completely unbelievable, to be honest, and it's so odd because I found out back in November, but I had to keep it to myself. I wasn't allowed to share it with anyone. And so it was this sort of strange feeling of being fantastically excited and then kind of damping it down because I couldn't talk about it. So now that it's out in the open, it's just a very odd feeling. It sort of feels very unreal.
And what would it mean to you to win?
I'm so delighted to have been put forward as one of the top three. The kind of final result in lots of ways doesn't matter, but I suppose the thing that makes this one so special is that it's voted on by the public. So to win would mean that there were lots of people out there who'd read my story and really loved it. So it has a real kind of special resonance, I suppose, rather than it being just, you know, it's almost luck of the draw sometimes as to how, you know, there's a sort of subjectivity, I think, always involved in judging things like this. But it would be very special.
I still think there's a place for awards like this for writing because, as you say, judging them can be quite subjective.
I think they're incredibly important for writers themselves and for the publishing industry. It can be very difficult to make a good living, quite honestly, as a writer these days. I think the average salary for or earnings for an author these days is around £10,000 a year, and that means there are a lot of people who are earning a lot less than that. So they're a valuable source of additional income in terms of those prizes. They're a valuable source of publicity in terms of your book actually being seen and getting out there into the sort of the public eye.
And is the short story your preferred form?
I love to read novels, and when I embarked on the MA here at Anglia Ruskin, I absolutely assumed that I was going to be a novelist. I took a short story module and found I really loved it, writing them. So in a way I fall into it. I am writing a novel as well, and I still really hope to be a novelist. But I suppose because I found that I was able to craft short stories, they're relatively swift to write. I mean, quite swift to write. They take me a long time to edit and get right. I suppose I'm rather kind of building the two in tandem. I'm working towards having a collection of short stories and working towards finishing this novel as well.
And what makes a good short story?
For me, there's something absolutely extraordinary about a really good story. It's finite. I think it's Vanessa Gebbe called it a kind of a little bubble of the finite in this infinite world. You know, when you start reading it, you've got 5, 10, 15 minutes, and that entire world is going to be there just for that time. A really good story you get to the end and it sort of lingers in your brain. It sort of expands your thinking. You can't stop thinking about it. There are routes off, pathways that people could have taken and things that you don't yet know the answer to and perhaps never will. And I think that's what I find so intriguing about them. And I think also because the very fact that they are short, you can consume it in one sitting. There's something very satisfying, I think, just as a reader in being able to do that and then think about it.
And people assume that because it's short, it won't be impactful, but that's not true, is it?
I think completely the opposite. If someone gets it right, when you read some of the real kind of masters of the form, there are stories that just linger and linger that I probably will never forget. If you can do it with such precision, so it kind of cuts through everything, and I think you can have tremendous impact with actually just a few words.
And who are the masters of the form for you?
I love Flannery O'Connor. I love Amy Bloom's work. Hilary Mantel writes some fantastic short stories. I really enjoyed reading Raymond Carver, John Cheever, Hemingway. There's so much to learn, and I find it so fascinating that there are thousands and thousands of short stories being written all the time, and yet every one is so unique. And this is extraordinary, I say, little bubble that you and a world you enter for a short time, and if it's done well, it remains with you.
Maybe if it's not working, it feels like the beginning of a novel. It can feel like a first chapter. You don't want that sense of wanting more. You want to feel complete. Maybe not all your questions answered, but complete.
Absolutely. That's, I think, one of the things that I learned by sort of studying some of those masters and understanding what was the difference between what they were doing and my sort of first attempts before I really knew what I was doing, because I either erred on the side of that not being enough of a sort of sense of completion, exactly that somehow really this should just carry on, you've only told half the story, or that I tied it up too neatly. It was so complete that there wasn't any of that impact, any of that joy of wondering or thinking about it. So that's my greatest learnings from my time, you know, studying the masters and then sort of reading around it.
And we're here at Anglia Ruskin University. You did the MA in creative writing here. You completed it last year. Yes. Would this story exist without that MA?
The story itself might exist, but I don't think it would exist in the form that it's in. I'd written some short stories before I came on the masters. In fact, back in 2010, I really started and I had just some really tiny bits of success. Read at a short story cabaret evening, effectively a couple of times down in Brighton, which was where I was living at that point. And I read alongside some fantastic short story writers. I mean, Tanya Hirschman read at the same time as I did. Vanessa Gebbie was another one. I suppose that was actually the point at which I realised that I had so much to learn, because I finished my story and there was, you know, lots of applause. I had lots of family in, it was great. But there was sort of nothing more. Whereas when they finished their stories, there was just a moment of silence and you could just feel that sense of awe, of people thinking, that sort of meaning flooding through the room. And I thought, I need that. That's what I want, which is how I came to do the masters in the end. So I suspect the story might have come to be. It was inspired by events sort of in 2015. You probably recall the dreadful terrorist attacks in Tunisia, and that was the sort of image there that really struck me, and I was very sort of moved and taken by sort of stories that I'd heard from that. I sort of ruminated on that, so I suspect I might have come up with Billy. He might have existed, but I don't think I'd have written it the same way.
At what stage did you think you were going to write a story about it?
I didn't ever set out to write a story about it, and it really isn't kind of set at that point. It was just one of those things, it just really moved me, and it was quite a lot later. I think it was the end of 2017, maybe the beginning of 2018, that the story came to me. It reflects that, but it reflects lots of other things. It was about other things that had happened in my and other sort of friends' lives, where their life was turned upside down by something. So it's about a much wider issue, and my intention was to talk about something bigger, but the setting was inspired by that.
And you mentioned short story cabaret earlier on. It seems to me that the short story is and has been going through a renaissance, maybe for the last 5 or 10 years, but that's continuing.
Yes, I think so, and I think it's really exciting. And I'm a bit of a Luddite, really, but my son's 15 and he reads Snapchat stories the whole time. I think that there's only more directions that the short story can go in. I think it's a very exciting time, really.
And what next for you?
I really need to finish this collection of stories, and I really want to finish the novel. I would love to publish those. I'll carry on writing short stories and entering them into odd competitions and so on, not least because I'm someone who really needs a deadline, and that's one of the things that they give to me. They force me to finish and get it there. So, you know, I would love to make writing the core of everything that I do. I wait a long time to do it, and I don't really want to let too much time drift on from now. I feel as though this competition, wherever I come in the sort of end results, can only help me to learn a huge amount about the way the whole business works, and hopefully for someone to notice what I'm doing and want to see more of it.
Well, I'm sure they will now. Congratulations to Caroline Wardvine on winning the Costa Short Story Award. And you can read her short story, that winning story, Breathing Water, on the Costa Book Awards website. Listening to that with me in the studio was our studio guest today on Bookmark, Kate Rhodes, who's here to talk about Ruin Beach. Kate, some of the things Caroline was saying, were they ringing true from your short story days, your short story writing days?
It really resonated with me, and it really made me want to go and read her short story. It sounds so interesting, doesn't it? I remember those desperate events back in 2015 in Tunisia, and it must have been quite difficult to write about that. So I'd really, really like to read her story. She's obviously writing with enormous commitment. Sounds like she really deserved to win. She's been working hard at her writing.
It's a great short story.
Fantastic. Well done, her. That's so lovely to win.
When you moved from short stories to novel, you must have felt like you were moving out of... Did you feel like you were moving out of a cupboard into a palace? You know, there's room to stretch and run a story a bit.
Yes. I think one of the things I felt certainly when I was writing poetry, because I always think a poem is like a photograph. It's just a really quick snapshot of a particular event or a particular place or a particular emotion. Whereas it's much more discursive when you're writing a novel. You can enter into a conversation with the reader. I suppose it's the sporting equivalent of, you know, the difference between being Usain Bolt and being Mo Farah. You know, you get to run and run with something that you enjoy talking about. And that's an art form in itself, because obviously you can't be one of those people standing there boring people senseless. You've got to make your long story as interesting as a short story, I think. So I often try to think of each chapter as a short story with a beginning, a middle and an end, so that the reader, you know, gets a payback at the end of each chapter. Otherwise, I think, you know, we're living in the kind of attention deficit generation, aren't we? We've got a very short attention span, and people are quick to put a novel down if it's not, you know, keeping them interested. You've got to kind of keep the pace going, I think.
And that relationship with the reader, it seems to me in crime, that's a really strong one, because you're second guessing your reader all the time, and you're giving them things to send them in the wrong direction sometimes.
Yes. It's definitely a reciprocal relationship, because you're giving them red herrings and they're expecting excitement from you. So you've got to kind of keep on providing them with what they want, and then they'll keep on enjoying your stories. And for me, it's such a bonus when you get an email from somebody or a message, you know, a Twitter message, just saying that they've found it unbelievable that the killer turned out to be who it was at the end of your book. That's a really satisfying thing. I've done my job well then, I guess.
Do you see it when you're reading other crime novels? Do you see the kind of red herrings being thrown out?
I'm terrible. I'm absolutely terrible. I'm constantly kind of trying to work out how other people do their plotting. I hope that, you know, if I eventually ever retire from writing, I'll just be able to go back to reading for pleasure. But right now I'm just looking at it and thinking, oh, how are they making that work? You know, it's a bit like deconstructing a clock. You know, you're taking all the parts apart to see what makes it tick.
Well, let's give you a break from that. Let's listen to your second choice of music now, which is Spandau Ballet and True. Why this one?
Well, I should apologise to people, because I know this song really divides people who think it's a kind of awful schmaltzy drone. But actually, I was in my late teens when this came out, and I was living in London. Again, it just is the soundtrack to a very happy time of my life. And there's, you know, you can say what you like, but Tony Hadley can sing. And his voice just seemed to be floating through every pub and nightclub that I went to for a whole year.
So true, funny how it seems, always in time, but never in line for dreams. Head over heels, went toe to toe. This is the sound of my soul.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our studio guest on Bookmark today is Kate Rhodes, here to talk about her crime novel, Ruin Beach. And Kate, we kind of touched on it before the music, plotting, really. Where, I mean, with crimes, that is the key thing, isn't it, the plot? Where do you start?
I try to write a synopsis before I kick off. I normally write about 400 or 500 words as a kind of blueprint for the whole story, so I can know exactly what the beginning, the middle and the end is going to be. But I'm afraid I'm really, really naughty. I digress from that a lot as I write the story, because I think, you know, with the best intentions, some characters just develop in a different way from what you expected. Events occur that have got better dramatic potential than you originally thought they had. And you've got to allow yourself to be led by the story to some extent. So sometimes I'll look back at that original kind of roadmap that I laid out for myself at the start and think, wow, I've really taken a lot of deviations from that. But it normally works, I think, to allow yourself that freedom. It's a bit like you set off on a journey when you're on holiday and you expect to end up in a particular town in France, but actually you end up going somewhere else. It doesn't really matter. It's all beautiful and the journey's fantastic. I think that you've got to really enjoy the writing. And if your plan starts to feel like a trap, you know it's not a good plan.
Where do you start? Do you start with the idea of the victim, or do you say, you know, I want to write a crime thriller where the motivation is fraud or revenge? What's your starting point?
It normally is location with me. I mean, if I think I'm going to, you know, I choose my location for a particular novel, like I chose London for the first 5 books, and I've chosen the Isles of Scilly for this set of books. And each one is set on a different island, and each island has got its own particular mythology, its own particular history and identity, which is very rich, very fruitful as a writer. So as soon as I start to do some research and drill down into that location, ideas for stories just start to fly around. And, you know, it's a question of narrowing it down to one rather than not having enough ideas for that particular book.
And you've got subplots as well that you keep running. So there's Ben's romance, his romantic life.
Yes, I think you've got to, if you're writing, for me anyway, I think if you're writing crime fiction, which is, you know, fraught with a lot of danger, a lot of death, a lot of, you know, really monstrous crimes, you've got to have a payoff for the reader, and that payoff is normally friendship or love. And I think I wanted to allow Ben, my central character, to have both friendship and love. So it would make him, again, that kind of layered character that I enjoy writing about.
And the victims, I mean, the victim in this one is a woman, but we learn about her. She's a mother, she's a daughter.
Yes.
It's important now, isn't it, that these are just not chunks of meat, usually female meat.
Yeah, it really worries me when people are only writing about vulnerable female victims. So I write about male victims as well. In this particular case, I chose a really, really strong woman who does something that I could never do in a month of Sundays as the victim. I wanted to have her death be a real travesty and have the whole community be up in arms about it, as they would do for such a, you know, strong woman. What she does is she's not just a deep sea diver, but she's a free diver. So she's one of those people who will dive deep, deep into the ocean without an oxygen tank and then return to the surface as a competitive sport, which is, you know, the whole sport of free diving. Now, the very idea of that for somebody like me, who's quite claustrophobic, is absolutely terrifying. But some people say it's incredibly peaceful. You're tunneling your way down to the bottom of the sea, and then you're rushing back up to the freedom of the air. So I wanted to make her a tough cookie, and I felt a genuine bit of sadness when she died at the start of the book.
And in terms of research, obviously you had to do all the research about the diving. And yeah. Do you do ongoing research about police procedures?
Yes, police procedure is something that you've just got to try to keep on top of. And down in the Isles of Scilly, where there are only 6 full-time policemen and women policing all 5 inhabited islands, that's pretty easy to do. You know, there are just the 6 of them going about their everyday business. And it has to be said that crime in the Scillies is pretty scant. You know, there aren't actually that many crimes. But you can know from speaking to the police on the Scillies that all of their systems are in place should a major event occur. And they've been incredibly helpful, actually. The police that I've spoken to on the Scillies have been really useful in my research.
Because your previous stories were set in London.
Yeah.
So the kind of policing in the Scilly Isles compared to London must be very different.
Absolutely. I mean, I've allowed Ben to carry some of that knowledge forwards with him because he used to work on the murder squad in the Met in London. So he's gone back to his native Scilly Isles, but with some of that London knowledge, which I wanted him to have when he starts to investigate murders in the Scillies.
Oh, thank you, Kate. We'll come back and chat to you a little bit more, but let's hear from Julia Golding now. Julia's first YA novel, The Diamond of Drury Lane, came out in 2006 and won the Waterstones Children's Book Prize and the Nestle Children's Book Prize. Since then, there have been many more books and many more prizes, including the Green Earth Book Award and the German Children's Literature Award. I met Julia when she came to Girton College to meet young readers and talk about her novel The Curious Crime. Before becoming a writer, Julia worked as a British diplomat and an Oxfam policy advisor. So I started by asking her how she moved from those roles to writing.
What happened was I've always wanted to be a writer. So in a way, the other jobs were the things I did along the way to being a writer. I actually studied English at Cambridge University at Girton College, and I had a huge love for literature. And at the end of that, I thought, well, am I going to go into a literary career, or am I going to go out and see the world? And going out and seeing the world won when I was 21. And so I suppose I had a really exciting 10, 15 years doing lots of different jobs, lots of travel. But when I had my first child, I started to think much more about writing again. And by the time number 3 came along and I was on maternity leave, I thought, right, stop thinking about it, get down and write a book. And so during my maternity leave, when the baby was asleep, I started writing, and I read the story to my daughter, the oldest one, as like a bedtime story. And having someone expecting you to produce something at the end of the day meant I had the discipline, because it would have been easier just to go to sleep when the baby was asleep. But I actually decided to get on and write a book, and that was the start.
Why YA and children's books? I know you were a new mother yourself, but was it always going to be that genre?
Oh, totally no. And also I write for adults. I have another pen name as Joss Sterling, so I've written a psychological thriller, very different kind of book, and that's aimed at an adult audience. But I did start with children's, and I suppose it was because it was the thing that was needed. My brain always thinks of stories all over the place in lots of different genres, suitable for different age groups. But what I had an audience for, and it's as simple as that, it's what the audience was at home. Because writing is a strange thing. It feels quite selfish going off to lock yourself in a room and do some writing. But having somebody enjoying the story made me feel, I don't know, justified in some way, gave me an excuse to do it.
And you're here at Girton College today, outside, waiting to come into this room. It's a very excited group of young readers. Do you get as much of a buzz from these events as they clearly do?
Oh, absolutely. Usually when you do a school event like this, the children will only know just a very tiny bit about you. So it is like you've got to catch their attention right from the start. I always describe it to people as a bit like doing a children's party with books. So rather than bending balloons into shapes, I'm going to try and get them excited about reading. What I have going for me, and any author has going for them, is that stories are immensely attractive. We all have that storytelling instinct. As soon as you start telling someone a story, they are going to listen because they want to know what happens next. And in this case, hopefully they're even more excited because the setting of the book that I'm talking about today, which is The Curious Crime, is a very large, mysterious science museum in which murders are taking place. You know, it's one of those kind of stories, a detective story. But the actual building is inspired by all the buildings I've known and loved. And one of those buildings is Girton College, where we are now, with its portraits on the wall and the oak beams and arched roofs. It's a Victorian building, so it's got really red brick, so it's very a striking building with towers and pinnacles. So they just need to look around them and they might even think up their own stories.
Well, talking of Girton College, we've got Jenny Blackhurst, who's the librarian here. What a nice job you have, Jenny.
Oh, I do, don't I?
And events like this, they're good for the college.
It's nice for us to play our part in the community because we very much want to be part of the community of Cambridge. And it's not just about 18-year-olds, because everyone needs the aspiration to be able to go on to university.
Yes, and Cambridge, there can be a little bit of town and gown, and so something like this helps break it down. Some of these children outside, this is possibly their first time in a Cambridge college.
Absolutely, and as a college we are increasingly working with young people from the age of about 11 upwards, not necessarily seeing them as Girton students in the future, but just to give them that aspiration that university is available as an option for them.
And this is a YA novel. Do you remember what your favourite book was, maybe when you were a young teenager?
Ooh, I can remember very clearly the first time I read Jane Eyre, because I had a cold, so I was at home and I was given Jane Eyre to occupy me, and I have very vivid memories of that.
Well, outside, Julia, waiting to come in, I noticed there are lots of very excited children. Mm. They're mainly girls. Is that an issue, do you think, getting young boys to read?
I think that may have been just who you saw, because we've actually got Coton Primary, which is a mixed primary, and we've also got the University of Cambridge Primary, which is a new one, the one on the Eddington new complex. So it is actually going to be a mixed audience. But it is true that girls find it easier to keep the reading habit. I don't know, if you are a parent listening to this, the best thing you can do for your boys is read with them. Even if they're teenagers, read them something which you all laugh at. A comic novel, like a bit of P.G. Woodhouse or something funny, because if they see you reading, they will read too. You can't really expect your kids to carry on reading if you're not reading in front of them. It's, you know, they catch the habit from you. So that's absolutely the best thing you can do. And hopefully by coming to an event like this, the book has a strong female heroine, but it also has a strong male detective heroine who's from Algeria, so from an ethnic background. So I'm also trying to say that we need diversity in characters too. So hopefully somebody, a couple of boys in the room, might find it is their book by the time they've read it.
And you've got a lot of books under your belt, quite a range, quite different. Are there certain themes though that you find yourself going back to?
Well, this particular book has a new theme for me, which is something I'm interested in over the last few years, which is about how science is explained to the public. And that's the driving force behind the book, and how that interacts with the kind of questions people ask of society, you know, questions of meaning and purpose. And I think authors are always looking at that in different ways. It's the why of us. Why are we like what we are like? Because that is what you're always asking when you're thinking up a character. Other themes that I return to are things like climate change, environmental stories, and I do have a track record of quite feisty female heroines. So that may be something. It's hard to analyse yourself. I mean, it'd be easier for me to look at my, you know, do somebody else's, but I think that's what I would say. So if you go to one of my books, you get strong women and an interest in meaning and purpose of the how of life.
And climate change, environmental issues, those are big issues, yeah. But young people are hungry for that and can deal with them.
So in fact, the book I mentioned where I started writing is a book called The Secret of the Sirens, which is the first of a quartet. And that is absolutely, it's looking at climate change, but using mythical creatures as a way of giving voice to nature, saying you've got to do something about this. So again, it's for children.
From these events, do you get ideas? Do you come away with perhaps ideas for characters and novels?
I'm not sure I'd be spending long enough with the children to get an idea about characters, but I tell you what I do get, and that's names. Sometimes in the signing queue, someone will come up with those fantastic names. I think, oh, I'm using that. There was, for example, I met a girl up in Edinburgh, 12-year-old girl, a black girl, who was called Raven. I thought, you've just got the best name. You completely suit your name. So I've actually used it a few years later for a heroine in a detective story. That, you know, you never know. You might find yourself in a book if you've got a name that snags my attention.
And Julia Golding's visit to Girton College was supported by Faraday in schools. Her novel, The Curious Crime, is published by Lion Children's Books. Listening to that with me was Kate Rhodes. We've been talking about her novel, Ruin Beach, which is published by Simon & Schuster. Kate, just to go back to what Julia was saying about names, that it's very important, particularly for your central character, Alice Quentin and Ben Kitto. They have quite different feels about them. How do you come up with the name?
Yes, I mean, I think with Ben, his full name is actually Benesek, which is a Cornish name, and Kitto is a Cornish name as well. In fact, Kitto springs from the islands. So I really wanted to make him a man of the islands. So his name just sort of, you know, it sounds very enduring, I think, Benesek. And I like the fact that it's quite unusual and that he's slightly embarrassed by it and always calls himself Ben. It's useful as well.
And Alice Quentin, why Alice?
Yeah, I've always had a thing about Alice in Wonderland, so I think Alice had to be the first, you know, the first female character that I wrote about. Something so marvellous about the idea of a character just disappearing into this kind of fantasy world. I suppose that's what I felt like when embarking on writing a first novel. Quentin's just a good, solid name. I like anything that starts with a Q.
A Q. And are you a full-time writer now?
I am, yeah, for my sins. I am a full-time writer. And it's become a little bit easier because the latest series of books has actually been optioned for TV, which means
fantastic.
That... thank you. Yeah, no, it's really pleasing. The company who've actually bought the rights to these books produced The Fall and The Line of Duty, so they're quite an experienced TV production company. So basically it gives this series some longevity, because I mean I think that we all know that not every single thing that gets commissioned for TV gets on the TV. It's not that easy a journey to get green lit, but in the meantime it means that I really do have to keep writing. It's an encouragement to keep writing. Somebody believes in these books, and you know, not just in the print form, but thinks they'd be good on TV as well. And I feel like I must be doing something right. I must be learning my craft.
Do you have a routine? What is your working routine?
Yeah, I suppose I'm unusual in that I don't think that mornings are for writing. Not for me, anyway. That's partly why I'm here in the morning, Lee, talking to you, chatting and drinking a cup of tea.
That's a much nicer thing to do.
It absolutely is a lot, right? You know, a lot more fun than sitting down and kind of beating your brains up to try and get a few interesting words out of it. For me, the morning is about taking some exercise, greeting the world, doing the laundry, going to Tesco's, whatever it is that you need to do. And then once I've done all the stuff that I need to do, I can sit down with a clear mind just after lunch and go for it until dinner. That's my time.
Fueled,
ready, absolutely, full of pasta and good intentions, normally.
And tell me about Killer Women.
Oh, Killer Women is a great passion of mine. Yeah, we started up 3 years ago. It's really a support group for crime writers, female crime writers, most of whom are based in London. A few of us are slightly more far-flung, like Ellie Griffiths down on the South Coast and me here in Cambridge. And there are about 20 of us. And we meet regularly. We run a festival every year in London, the Killer Women Crime Writing Festival, where we have lots of interesting speakers and also workshops to encourage people, men and women, to write. And also next year we're going to be doing a mentorship scheme for new writers, which is really exciting. You know, we've got funding to do that, which is lovely. It means that it'll be really heavily subsidised for people who want to do that, and it'll be on merit only. So people will send in their writing. We'll decide who, you know, is ready and best placed to be mentored, and then they'll get to work with a professional crime writer. So we're really chuffed about that.
So my next question, what's next for you? There's quite a lot on your agenda at the moment. You're carrying on writing this series and Killer Women.
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to write, you know, probably 6 in this series, I imagine. I'm really enjoying writing them, so there doesn't seem to be any real reason to stop. And Killer Women as well, absolutely.
Lots on your plate, but lots of nice things.
Absolutely.
And the question that we ask all our guests here on Bookmark is, what are you reading at the moment? What's on your bedside table?
I'm actually reading Becoming by Michelle Obama. Becoming Michelle Obama. It's an extraordinary book, incredibly well, beautifully written, about the experience of being the first lady. And it makes me wish that she was the president of the United States, really, I've got to be honest. But yeah, beautifully written, and also a spellbinding tale of a young woman with serious aspirations who actually, you know, is achieving fantastic things through her foundation, through her charitable work.
You're not reading a crime novel, do you? I wonder if it kind of puts you off when you're writing, if you read other crime novels.
Yeah, it's weird. When I lie in bed reading something to sort of, you know, to relax and put myself to sleep, the last thing I want to read is crime. It feels like a busman's holiday, really. I read crime for research. I'll read other people's books because I enjoy them during the day. But when I get into bed and I want to read something fantastic, it's often going to be a biography, an autobiography, rather than fiction.
Well, thank you, Kate. It's been lovely talking to you. Just a heads up on our next show. We are sticking with crime. Our studio guest is, well, fellow killer woman Ellie Griffiths. She'll be here talking about her latest novel, The Stone Circle. We'll also hear from travel writer Tim Moore. He'll be telling us why he decided to travel across Trump voting counties and states in the US in a Ford Model T. And Carol Carmen will be chatting about her novel, Gingerbread Children. Just a reminder that all the old episodes of Bookmark are on the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.co.uk. You can find, as I say, all old episodes there, as well as some of the many wonderful shows that are on this radio station. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Kate. This is Take Five by the Dave Brubeck Quartet. Why this one?
I had to choose this. In my husband's eyes, I've committed a terrible sin by ever choosing Spandau Ballet. He's a diehard jazz fan, and he introduced me to jazz, which I'm grateful for, and I really love this classic jazz theme. Da 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 da